Back in the early 2000s, I founded an organization called Expanding the Circle of Excellence. The mission of that organization is similar, or was similar, to what I'm striving for with Achievement Factors, that is, promoting high achievement among students of color. But I went about things a little differently back then. Back then, I would reach out to education policy experts that I had either met at a conference or I had encountered through research, and see if I could get them to translate some of their research findings into practical solutions that parents could implement. So when I was able to do that, or once I was able to find those who were willing, I put together education summits. And at those summits, they would come together with parents and their children and to share some of what they had learned and, again, how parents could implement them. Back then also, I had found an advisor for that organization. Her name was Sharon Fries Britt. She was a professor at the University of Maryland. And I first found her name through a publication called Reaching the Top that the College Board had published back then, looking at success strategies across different communities. So it turns out she's still at the University of Maryland and she's still producing research on that topic. And I thought it would be great to go back and to talk to her and find out more about what she's been doing, whether she's discovered any new insight, so that she could share that with you. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. This is my first interview, and I'm happy to be here at the University of Maryland with Dr. Sharon Fries Britt. We're going to be talking about some scholarship and some ideas surrounding high achievement. And could you introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for coming out today with everything going on with all the viruses. I'm glad you can make it and we can be here. So my name is Sharon Fries Britt, professor here of higher education at University of Maryland. I'm excited to be having this conversation.
Excellent. Thank you. And so I wanted to say a little bit about how I first came in contact with you, which is through a publication way back in the 2000s. And we talked about it a bit before I started the recording, but it's a publication called Reaching the Top. Mm-hmm. And back when I first started focusing in on this topic and wanting to do more about it, I remember reading this and looking at all the great information that focused on research concerning minority high achievement, and I saw your name in it. Mm-hmm. And once I saw that you were at the University of Maryland and basically right down the street from where I was working, I said, well, I had to reach out.
Right.
So could you share a bit about this publication, Reaching the Top, and what it's done for you?
Yes. So it's, you know, that was like 1999, just before we were going into the year 2000. And it was actually, it sort of parallels with my having left my administrative career in 96 and transitioned into faculty life really unexpectedly.
Okay.
I was studying the Meyerhoff Scholars for my dissertation, and I had the incredible opportunity to be invited on that national task force. It was just sort of a perfect storm of opportunity because I was interested in high achievers. The literature on Black students was really from a deficit perspective.
Okay.
And I couldn't find a lot of scholarship that was framing and understanding Black intellectual capacity in the diversity of expression that we see other students explain.
Okay.
And so I wanted to study it for my dissertation, high achievement, and really claim that and name that and reportrait the image and understanding of Black intellectual capital. Now, we know we have a range of Black intellectual, other historians have talked about it. We have brilliant scholars, but it seemed like we had lost something. So when the Reaching the Top task force, it was really probably through a connection of Dr. Hrabowski was on that task force, but also Donald Stewart. Donald Stewart at the time at the College Board was also connected with my then academic advisor. And so I think he learned about my research and work. And it was just a great launch of being at a table with a lot of incredible scholars from different disciplines. So for me, it was pivotal in shaping my sense of understanding that I was doing something that was of value and also of interest for other scholars. You know, Edmund Gordon and others were on this task force who were just brilliant scholars. So, and part of me was also like, wow, how did I end up? Because it was, like I said, I mean, I was not young in my professional career, but just starting my academic career. So, so it was very pivotal. And, and so it's, I'm glad you actually reminded me of that report because it's funny 20 some odd years later to, but it made a big difference for me.
So you said a couple of things back that I want to pick up on. I want to make sure that those who are listening know more, know about these topics that you touched. One is the Meyerhoff Scholars. Could you say more about the those scholars in the program?
Yeah. So the Meyerhoff Scholars Program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County under the, you know, the leadership of Dr. Hrabowski and other, he's had other leaders who've run the program, but his vision and his work. I had the opportunity to actually did my internship with Dr. Hrabowski, Freeman Hrabowski back in, and Ken Matten, who's a psychologist on that. But it's a program in its original form that was really designed for African-American male high achievers in STEM fields coming to study. And I think the M1s and the M2s, I studied the M1s and M2s. I think it was around 19, I can't remember the exact year, if it was 96 when it changed, but there, it began to then broaden its definition to, it still predominantly serves students of color, but it's now for men and women and, and diverse groups of students, but an incredible program that really concentrates this opportunity structure for students to learn in very supportive environments. They are very capable. It's a real, it's a program that brings not only the academic kinds of opportunity, but also familial, family, kind of community, other skills, travel, cultural. So, and it's expanded a lot over the years. I couldn't even give it justice, but it's a over 30-year program.
Wow, okay.
So I think they're in year 32 now. I think they just had their 30th anniversary like a year or so ago. So they're on 32. So it is a well-established program. The graduates have gone on to do incredible things, to get advanced degrees, just an incredible program.
Okay. And I will, we can come back to that.
Yes.
Because what I'd like to be able to do is to explore some of the lessons that you learned with your scholarship in that program. And we'll talk about how that relates to the broader topic we're trying to cover. So the other thing that you mentioned that I wanted to touch on again is deficit model.
Yes.
So I know what that means, having worked in education, but the audience might not know what that means when we say that.
So what I mean and what others have meant about deficit model is sort of seeing, discussing and seeing Black students from more of a negative perspective of what they can't do and not and characterizing and talking about students in deficit ways and negative ways of underachievement, having lower expectations, not seeing their capability across a larger spectrum of ability and range. And so, and characterizing and talking about their, particularly when Black students don't achieve or are successful, looking at them as the reason for that lack of success, rather than thinking about this systemic challenges or the deficiencies of systems. Like systems have deficiencies too. Not that we're all perfect and we don't have, but a student's inability to learn may not rest on her or him solely.
Right.
What's happening in the person who's teaching's perception of their ability to even get, you know, the stereotypes, the assumptions that, you know, and it can happen across lots of different forms of identity for a student, but for Black students in particular, and we actually have a stereotype that intellectual capital doesn't rest as much with our community as it does with other communities. That so those stereotypes can be applied in pervasive ways that create these deficit perspectives along with other. So that's what I,
No, thank you. Thank you. That's good. That's good. So how did you first get into this scholar, this line of scholarship? Like what was the spark?
Yeah. You know what? That's such a great question. So I started my career in administration in higher education.
Okay.
And I, was working with all students, but working at a predominantly white institution, which I've been affiliated with the University of Maryland for a very long time. I love my institution. I have high regard for my institution, but we have a lot of challenges that other institutions have had. So historically over time here, I was working with students trying to help them be successful as an administrator. So when I started doing my research and my dissertation, I wanted to study, I knew that the literature wasn't matching up with what I was seeing in my office. Like, in other words, I'm reading about Black students who are underachievers, who are not passing, but I'm meeting with Black students who are just incredible, talented, you know, they come into my office and they're able to express themselves well, they know what they want to do, they have a vision, but then they're telling me about these not just micro inequities. They're talking about aggressive ways in which they're being treated by faculty, literally, or other administrators,
right,
soon as they walk in a door. And that was problematic for me. I was like, what is happening? But I also understood it because as a Black professional, I've navigated some of these spaces.
Right.
And so, but it didn't mean I wasn't positive about them. And it made me say, we need to I want to change the literature so that we see the kinds of evidence of success.
Right.
And ironically, even though I wrote and thought about and spent my time thinking about high achievers, because that's also like an oxymoron for a lot of folks.
Right.
So I was like, we got to get comfortable with being able to say this because we have plenty of this, like everybody else. But ironically, over the years, even if you're high achieving, doesn't mean we escape all the racial kind of.
Right.
Or the battle fatigue or the other stuff. But we have to develop other systems to work through.
Right.
So that's what drove me. And I have literally my entire career, even if it's not on students, it's on promoting the sense of excellence that exists in our community. Mm.
So this is interesting because by describing it the way that you do, what you're setting up is this idea of potential. So we think of achievement strictly based upon the results.
Right.
But what you're saying is, I've met people who I know can be achievers.
Oh, yeah.
Despite or perhaps standing against those systemic
issues. Whole continuum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think of it as the whole continuum. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's the obvious achievers based on various factors or ways of calculating achievement. So in the academy, it's funny you would say that because in the academy, people asked me in the early days, well, what do you mean about high achieving Blacks?
Mm.
And I used to say, these were potential funders.
Right.
Most of these folks were white folks who would say, well, what do you mean by high achievers? I said, who's a high achieving white student? Mm-hmm. I literally would give that back to them. And they'd go, well, I mean, students in honors. I said, Black students in honors. Like I got that all the time. Like, what if they couldn't wrap their head almost around, what do you mean? I said, who are high achieving white students? Who do you think of as a high? And they would say, well, those who are in honors. I'm talking about that group. The only difference is they're Black students. And that was difficult for people to get. And some people challenged me on that and said, but is that the only measure of achievement? And I said, no, it's not the only measure of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to break through this notion of high achievers, I got to also show we show up in the same ways that you do traditional measures of achievement.
Yes.
They're in honors programs. Mm-hmm. They're in high performing programs.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only one slice. So to go to what you're saying, I am talking about potential as achievement too.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in the human dynamic, it's like we ought to be thinking about that. Like a lot of the students who are in the middle, who are highly capable, need the support. They need the...
Right.
So how are we teaching? How are we thinking to enhance? And that's true for anybody, generally, but particularly for, if I think about Black students, like if we don't see the potential there right away, how much investment are we giving so we cultivate it?
Right.
So we help them see it. Mm. So how do we spark that in them?
So that's really good. So I've been wrestling with this the last few days, thinking a lot about Spark. I've already used it in talking about or asking you about how you began, but I have also been thinking about, you know, those moments when you meet a student, they could be young, they could be older, and there's something that's on fire.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
you meet that, you can just tell.
Yeah.
Something has happened with this student where it doesn't even matter whether they say, oh, I want to be an astronaut. You know, you have, you remember that thing where you would ask a young child, and some children, when they say they want to be an astronaut at 5 or 6, they wind up doing that.
Right.
You know, some may not, but whether they know what they want to do career-wise or not, there's just something that's on fire, and you could sense it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what you're saying. You've met, you know, there were a lot of students that you were meeting, and you could tell that they had that.
Well, I would even say that I would even step back and say is this too. That the assumption I made is that we have this gift when we're interacting with each other, particularly across the dynamics of senior administrators and students and faculty and students, that I make the assumption that this person before me, there's something in them to be cultivated. Mm. There is a talent in them.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we, in collegiate environments or in workplaces or in different, help to bring out the best of that? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I saw some kids who came in with an incredible spark.
Right.
But it's also having a presumption of,
okay,
I'm here to help you do your best.
Okay.
And
okay,
we want you to do your best. So right, how do we not cultivate the talent of our human capital, mm-hmm, the talent that we have? Mm-hmm. So I make, and I know people are all over the spectrum in terms of their abilities, but I assume that if you're bringing in and admitting a student to a Research One university,
mm-hmm,
they've made it through. We've made some okay assessments about your capability.
Right,
right,
right, right, right.
And it's, and because we already know from the retention literature that students drop out for non-academic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not because they're not academically capable.
Sure, okay.
It's because something else is also happening in the environment. And that's been a fact in the retention literature for quite some time. So
okay,
high achieving students drop out a lot. Mm. Something else is going on. Some of it may be their own issues that they're dealing with, and particularly
okay
students these days, but it's also things that's happening in the interaction in the environment.
Right.
And particularly in these tough, non-traditional fields.
Okay.
Where the stereotype of who's in them don't look like them.
Right,
so they're
right
going through stuff that we've learned firsthand in our research team about what that looks like for them. Mm. It's a lot.
So this is good. This is a good way to speak a little bit more about the scope of research that you have
yeah
written about.
Yeah.
So you have numerous papers that can be found on your website, and you've given multiple talks, and
yeah
you've done a lot. You've been out, and you've had an opportunity to share, you know, what you've discovered,
mm-hmm,
you know, while researching. Could you say a little bit more about, you know, the scope of research that you've
sure
engaged in over the years?
So I appreciate your being aware of it, because so thank you for that. So let me just say this about my research: it's a particular type of investigation. That means you're on the ground with students. You're out
mm
interviewing. You're in these discussions,
mm-hmm,
not dissimilar to what we're having, but around a strategic set of interview protocols
okay
around their academic experiences. I've kind of stayed, when it comes to STEM students in particular, Black students in STEM, and actually even outside of STEM, I've, because of what the literature has been about, I've tried to stay in particular arenas where I'm asking about their pre-college experiences, what happened with their fam, how did
mm
their fam, what happened in their, so I've got these arenas. One
okay
is, I try to understand what happened prior to going to college, like
right
what kind of schooling did they get, how did their parents interact with them, what kind of engagement, and then the understanding some of that schooling process. But then once I get into the interview where I'm trying to understand what it's been like for them to be a student, trying to understand when did they come into an awareness of their academic ability, or
right
who, how did they understand
mm
their sense of self-efficacy about
yes
their ability to do, say, math or physics, or and who was instrumental in that? And
okay
so I've learned a lot of K-12 teachers
right
are pivotal.
Mm.
Okay, so
okay
what those K-12 teachers affirm, inspire,
right
is amazing.
Okay,
and important, because it, you could have your parents, but the so that became a particular. So we wrote a
right
piece on that, on
okay
K-12 teachers and their influence, and but then what we've also learned is that for sure teachers throughout, so at the collegiate level. But at the collegiate level, depending on the kind of institution a student went to,
mm-hmm
size,
mm-hmm
a type of institution,
right
something gets disconnected from the kind of affirmation, the
yes
kind of encouragement
right
of faculty. So the navigating of the faculty space with students is what we've learned a lot in our research becomes very different,
right,
particularly for high-achieving Black students in STEM fields in particular.
Okay.
And so I ask about that. And then we ask about a whole host of relational pieces around peers,
okay,
around climate on a campus,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm
all those kinds of aspects
mm-hmm
matter. So I've kept that those domains as a big part. But then over the years, what I began to also ask about, and this, and I'll say this, and I'll just stop, is
no, it's fine.
What we thought of in our work as studying Black students
mm-hmm
emerged into studying and understanding within Black differences. So
mm
we, a lot of the Black students who were in programs, because
mm-hmm
around the country, identified as Black, but
right
their home country context was not the U.S.
Right.
So
right
we had a growing number. I've seen a growing number in our, and we're like interview-wise through small focus group or individual interviews
right
over the years. It's well over 450 to close to 500 students
okay
that I've had these conversations with, plus a national survey through the American Institutes of Physics that
mm-hmm
we just completed as part of that task force. So
mm-hmm
I consider those as data points of understanding
yes
their experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we've learned that that's a much more diverse group. So we have written with written a couple of articles on learning race in the U.S. context,
mm-hmm,
learning within Black students. So this
right
is a Black American, African,
yes,
and Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And being in these science programs and having different perspectives
yes
on the learning context and
right
what's expected of them. So all of that were spinoffs of this work. Yes, it wasn't what we were intending to do, but it emerged as we learned more about all these areas I've just talked about, particularly that peer interaction action. So it's been a unique, we had to be open. I had to be sort of co-constructivist with my team.
Yes.
Let's see where part of this is going to take
us. Yeah, and that's very interesting because when I think about Stephen Biko, and he used to talk about levels of consciousness and how as one emerges, as their consciousness emerges, they gain more efficacy. And so I did read one of an excerpt of one of the other things that you had written about an African student here in the U.S. and how he couldn't even figure out what people are talking about. Like, what do you mean, race? Like, how is that impacting what I'm doing?
I got a chill when you just said that because I went right back to that interview. And actually, I even went to Arnold when I presented. We presented this work at NCORE, and the room was full of mainly African students who were having an epiphany. We haven't written about this yet because all of us are doing, but they were having an epiphany of how they were raised in a generational household where they now, unlike their parents being in the U.S., are experiencing things that Black students were talking about. And so, but for a number of those students, they were like, I didn't even know what was coming up when people said race.
Right.
It just was not their context. Until later, when something else continued to happen, particularly for a lot of our students from Nigeria and from different African countries have been well-educated who are showing up here, okay? And so this disconnect of how people are responding to them in the academic community has been an area that for some of them, not all, obviously, I'm not even talking to, but there's been a wake-up call. Like, what is this about?
I mean, it's what it provides, too, is an interesting way of looking at you could almost describe it as the impact of race when you're aware of it. You know, if you are if you go into a situation having experienced a negative, having had negative racially oriented experiences, you may have you may go into the next experience with some knowledge about what that's like, how it happens, how you're likely to respond, or perhaps some reflection on how to respond differently, perhaps. But you know, that preparation or that priming from previous experiences where you know race was a factor perhaps plays into, you know, the next one. But if you haven't had that, and you come into it.
Or, and you're hitting right on something that's so important, or you didn't have the language to explain what felt uncomfortable. That's kind of what we've also been learning. This is that when these students take additional courses or learn and get the language, like, oh, that was a micro inequity, or that was, or they get the social, cultural, political context of the U.S. better situated in their understanding, then they develop the language. Like, they're like, that's what that's called? I had that. I didn't know that's what that, or that's why this part. So you're right. It's not only if you didn't know what it was, and so you're getting it, but also if you've had some experience, because several of them knew that something wasn't quite right, but they didn't know, you know, what that is, or they shook it off as, I just got to work harder, until that working harder wasn't the way that it was moving the needle. Someone was still saying, you should drop the major, you're not ready for this.
Yeah, there was a phrase in the piece that I wrote that said, that race will catch up to them.
Yes.
And so if it sounds like that's what you're describing.
That's what I'm describing. Like, we framed that as when racism catches up with you. So in our Learning Race in the U.S. Context framework, which what we're trying to do now with that work, although each of us is off doing a lot, is we wanted to build a larger database of interviewing more, actually more Caribbean and Sub-Saharan Africans, because we need to diversify the pool. And that's a long process. So. And again, because that was a spinoff from our work, and that's based on a small N, but we're seeing it's gotten so much traction. I cannot tell you how much traction. I get more comments from people saying that article spoke to what I've experienced. And from African students.
Who
are like literally just reaching out saying, I saw your article, and oh my God, it's basically, it's caught up with me. And I'm trying to figure out, what do I do?
Well, that's great. Thank you for speaking more about that. So let's talk now then about some of those. You've already talked about some of the lessons you've learned. You talked about K-12. I mean, you've talked about teachers, the importance of teachers. You've talked about climate. Let's spend a little bit more time on you know, the lessons that you've learned, and then from there talk about what some of the precursors for success are. So, you know, earlier we were talking about not, you know, the deficit model is important because we need to understand what's happening to students, but we also want to talk about what leads to success for students as well. And so, you know, if we could spend some more time on that, again, sort of the, you know, what some of the general themes that you've picked up on in terms of this, the success that you've seen students experience, and what some of the precursors are for that.
Yeah. So, great question. And this is where I think, so first of all, let me just say, parents and guardians and family matter. So who, on those early ways that we engage with young people in our lives, our children, and the kind of practices in a family's dynamic. So we heard a lot from students over the years that their parents always took them to the museum. Or, so it's these early patterns of just exposure.
Okay.
So, or playing games together, or building, or pulling things apart, encouraging them to be creative and encourage them to be inquisitive.
Okay, yes.
Taking them to, even if the parents didn't have any background in it, but also in our experience, a lot of the parents actually have some STEM or some engagement or capability. If families can afford it, getting the kind of tutoring or support or coming up with systems to do that. So as soon as a young person is showing the need, and it could be as early as third grade or fourth grade, or to try to quickly get on those support systems. So, and being creative about that. So it could be an older sibling, but oftentimes it's not. It's like church programs or having like tutoring or just getting the additional support.
Let me ask you that. Ask you about that for a second, because one thing I recall, our sons went to a competitive high school here in the D.C. area, and people wouldn't really talk openly about tutoring. You knew people were getting, you know, we're getting that service, the support service, as you mentioned. But I guess if it felt like no one wanted to say it openly because it would be an admission of, you know, of a deficit.
Wow, that's interesting.
And,
yeah.
But this is at a competitive school. But again, we knew people were getting it. Could you speak to that like how we, the way that we go about thinking of, you know?
Well, I don't, you know, it's interesting you would say that. I don't have data to drive this, but my experience has been that that's a pretty, our daughter went to a competitive high school in the area too, but it was pretty open. Everybody would, like, people, it was not only that people said they were getting tutoring, it was the privileges associated with private tutoring or in your home tutoring. Like, I think it's become, so maybe, I don't have an answer for why people might, maybe it's, could sometimes every school is a little bit different, but some people want to kind of make it seem like their kids are doing it all by themselves.
Right.
But I don't think that's the case. I think most people understand that, and even, and it's also a little bit of engineering who you're studying with as well. You know what I mean? So I think there's a lot more intentionality in that. And, and maybe almost, some people would argue too much so.
Some people,
like, I think you have to judge it on your own child's situation. Like, what is the, without it feeling like it has to be this competition or this. But I think we're required, in order to be in these competitive programs and to do well, students need, and the kind of time we have in school, students need the additional help. I can honestly say as a parent, I mean, math was not my, I'm more of a writer and a critical thinker and things. I had to get tutoring for, we had to get tutoring for our daughter pretty early on the math skills. Like, I just knew that. I knew I was going to be tapped out. Maybe you lasted longer.
No.
But I was real
clear. I would have
needed
it to,
But I also understood we had the privilege to pay for that. So that's the piece.
Right.
That's what I mean when I say, it is a challenge because there tends to be an economic set of issues with this because parents want the best for the kids, but they may not be able to afford. It's not inexpensive. So being creative about how you make that happen if you don't have the money.
Right.
So that takes me back to your question about success. I think we have to, unfortunately, I think sometimes the students who are doing well also have these forms of capital in their family to do well. So their parents either understand the systems, or it's particularly in the Black community. So we have to still, we have to care about and figure out how we close that kind of gap and provide those opportunity structures for all students. So our school programs, and I'm not putting it all on K through 12 because I didn't even think at the collegiate level, we need to be okay about saying, how do we help students go back and sort of retool or re-get some of the skills that they need to get? You know, some colleges and universities don't do any remediation because that means we don't have the best and the brightest.
Yes.
But guess what? A lot of our students still need some retooling. Mm. Best example I will give on this came from a young man I was interviewing years ago. He's now a practicing physicist. I'll never forget.
Mm.
He had gone to Morehouse.
Okay.
And he was sharing an example with us about how in the classroom, the difference between a professor who, when you went to grad school at a white school, made a comment about, you should have learned this already. How come you don't know this, right?
Mm.
And so he was saying, in that moment, it was a beautiful quote, he said, no one gets this stuff. He said, and when he had a black professor at Morehouse, he said, listen, the black professor would look at them and say, you don't get this. I know you don't, because it took me a while to get it. So the difference of how we enter
a
professor would say, it takes a while to get this. So the strategies that a faculty member used, and I remember the student said that his grad school program with Promley, I think it was at Rice, I can't remember the exact school, but he said, that really bothered him because he said, I know that I can get this, but I'm just still working through.
Right.
What I mean? So
yes, it's not,
you still
it's
need
not,
help.
Right. He wasn't saying, I will never understand it.
Right.
I just don't get it right now.
Right. And he was talking about combining quantum mechanics with something else. And he said, look, when you overlay all these different kind of theoretical concepts, I need to get this differently.
And he was
saying the professors who do it well first acknowledge that they didn't get it the first time someone taught it to them. Most of these scientists will tell you, I had to keep studying.
Like
jumping. So when a professor says, you didn't learn this already, I'm learning it in this context with this new concept you're giving me. So be willing to help my brain get wrapped around
it. Yes, yes. No, that's good. That's good.
So
this is good. So we've talked about several factors. You've already touched on some of the early things to do.
Yes.
So let's spend a little bit more time on that. In some of the previous posts that I've done, I have been focusing a lot on literacy and some of the ways that parents could consider exposing their children to difficult concepts, with books and such.
Right.
Is there anything else about the college experience that if you were mentioning earlier that you asked some other students about their pre-college experiences, some of the other things that they've done or some of the contributing factors to their success?
Yeah, this is just a real simple one, but it's very real. And it's the extent to which, and it's not so much that our subjects have talked about this, but some have in different ways. It's the extent to which families understand structure matters, like systems. Students' academic processes are systemic and systems. So developing certain skills about how to be in those systems. So managing your energy and time.
Right.
Planning processes, thinking ahead. And so that's why college preparatory curriculums in high school help those students. Like learning, you learn in those schools how to go talk to the teacher. Why it's important to sit. So for families that are not in, so we have to help take out of those situations and say, you know what, like for, you know, my daughter used to laugh at us. We started family meetings when she was 4 years old.
Okay.
And a 4 year old, you would say that's kind of, my peers used to tease me. I said, it wasn't about the family meetings, it was about helping her learn how to talk and have a conversation and say, well, express that again. We don't fully. So to, that's the words, that's the language, that's the process, the engagement.
Yes.
So there's a, you may not choose to do it that way, but we are preparing our young people for, and sometimes I think we don't think of it that way.
Right.
You're going to be moving through some grades in a system where the degree to which you're able to express yourself, handle yourself, know that you may not fully understand how do you ask for help, that you have a right to ask for help, how to be engaged. So adding that structure, adding teaching a process, like with as a family, if you don't know it, going to someone else. Like I often would say to young people, you know, even now in college, let's understand that this is a system. There are administrators, there's an academic. Like sometimes we have to explain the system.
Right.
Systems matter so that students don't feel awkward, like, okay, where do I go? So when they say, I don't know where to go, they really mean that sometimes. So sometimes we have to not assume, and particularly for black students, I'm going to say, we're still dealing with a lot of first generation students. And there's a lot of, I think as a community, we put a lot of trust in that the systems are going to do the right thing.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, this what's interesting is I'm thinking about my relationship with my dad and how he was more of an authority figure than an educational figure.
Exactly. Yes.
And so
yes.
You know, he
I
was
had the
same one.
Dad. Similar.
So, you know, if I messed up, you know, my mother said, "Go see your father." You know, it was that kind of he was that, you know, I mean, I love my dad. But that was his role.
Right.
And so, you know, the question is when a child grows up, you know, relating to the authority figure just as the authority figure, does that person feel actualized enough?
Exactly.
So,
yeah,
you know,
like how do we cultivate?
Yeah.
First of all, we as parents have mm-hmm. to think about we have to keep growing.
Right.
Like we have to also keep growing.
Yes,
because
it's
actually
true.
When
it's
you
true.
One of the things I was late into parenthood and one of the things that I became abundantly clear for me is you start in school all over again when
yes,
you're kids.
Yes.
So
yes.
You also but hopefully this time around you're wiser and more mature
yes.
yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a process of there's a guy, I'm trying to remember his name. I want to say his name is Richard Rothstein. I don't know if you know his work. He does a lot of research on he was involved in a study. I thought this was fascinating when I read
yeah.
I think that's his name. They put microphones in families'
uh-huh.
homes to
uh-huh.
see how often parents communicate with their children. This
mm.
was a beautiful study.
Mm-hmm.
What they found is in by both class and by race, there were huge differences.
Mm.
And kids were told, if I have this all correct,
right.
in more black households, kids
yeah.
were told what to do.
Mm.
Go upstairs and do your thing. Go down there. In the white households, kids were asked, what do they think about what we're doing?
Wow.
So when I first read that study years
right,
ago,
right.
I was like, oh, this is very revealing.
Mm.
And he wasn't necessarily, it was, and so certain kinds of ways we discourse
right.
build up your thinking skills.
Yes,
so
yes,
if you were
yes.
asked and said, well, what do you think about that? What happened to, if versus being told, you're not expanding in the same way. And
yes.
I'm not giving the study due justice here,
right.
but the nature of it was pretty much that. Like, so
yes.
how do we engage kids? How do
right.
we talk? And I know for me when I read that, because I'm a higher ed person, I was reading, and I was becoming a mom. I had a little, that helped me think about how I was talking, because I was
right.
raised in a household by
right.
military dad. I was
right.
told a lot of what to do
yes.
by him or my mom, because
yes.
that's pretty much, they were more authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a little bit more open to, you know, ideas. My dad wasn't, he, and I, like you. I love both my parents have transitioned, but
mm-hmm.
he was a provider. He did,
right,
and he was,
right.
he had five kids, and
right.
y'all gonna toe the line.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean? So it's like, we weren't
you
asked too often
do it,
what
right.
we thought about.
right. Right. He didn't ask you. He didn't, he didn't say, well, what do you
what
think
do you
about
thinking? So I think those are things, you know, when we think about some things cost money, some things also cost, require us to learn more and to try to do better and to figure out how do we begin to build, like you said,
yeah.
this not only just even self-actualized, but just the sense of I should add
yes,
to a young
yes.
person.
Mm-hmm.
It is normal
mm-hmm.
for me to engage and to expect
mm-hmm.
to have a continual growth, you know, this new work on growth mindset.
Yes, yes.
So it's not just the growth mindset of kids. All
mm-hmm.
of us ought to have a continued, like, what do I need to know to do
mm-hmm.
better?
Mm-hmm.
And even asking our children. I
right.
just asked my 21-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
We just had a great conversation. I said, you know, has your dad and I done anything that really you feel will leave a wound for you that you
oh.
have to still heal?
Wow.
And you know what? Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough for this podcast, is if she listened, she would say she felt my expectations were really high.
Mm.
And we talked about that. She said, I understand it now, Mom,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but when I was 6 and 7 and 8 and you made me write 3 paragraphs or you stayed with
right,
me,
right.
it felt like a lot. And
mm.
she, so I learned a lot. We just
sure.
had this conversation.
Sure. No, that's, thank you for sharing
yeah.
that. Yeah. No,
yeah.
that's, yeah.
Yeah.
There's been a lot said about the role of high expectations. And in some cases, it's lauded as, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
what can help a student, you know, propel themselves forward, and in some
right.
context, you know, the,
yeah.
the so-called tiger mom, which
yeah.
sounds
yeah.
like a stereotype, although I feel like the term is self-applied as well,
yeah.
but
yeah.
but this idea of, you know, just continually pushing, you know, the child,
right.
But yeah, I guess perhaps there could be more conversation
yes.
About what the right balance
yeah,
is.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think, too, that, you know, each child is different.
Exactly.
Right? And
exactly.
so some children just
exactly.
come out and they're just doing,
right.
they're doing their
exactly.
own thing. You know, you don't even have to say anything. They
right.
already know. And then there's some children, no matter what you say, it's that they can't move off the dime, or
right.
they're not moving as fast. So we used to have this conversation about, I won't say which child, but just to say,
yeah, you better
one of our children, we would just have this conversation about urgency.
Yeah.
Now, it turned out that this particular child was doing what needed to be done. It's just that we couldn't see it in their faces they were, you know,
feeling the urgency.
Yes, yes. So,
and it's
that,
complicated. Right. I mean, when you think of parenting stuff, it's complicated. So I definitely have no expertise in saying what would be right or wrong there. And I think we hit sometimes and we miss. But what I know is conversation matters and empowering our young people to, and listening and hearing. Like, what do you need for studying or what area? And the earlier we do those kind of things, so back to your thing of what works and what we learned, I think that is important. And then, of course, also just the support in academic communities and systems all the way through.
Right.
Yeah.
This is good. So thank you. So, yeah, we've spent some time talking about what parents can do.
Yeah.
And we've talked about systems and the potential that students have, even within systems that may not necessarily support them. So let's talk a little bit more about, in a few minutes we have left, what you're doing now.
So I just finished up a huge project with the American Institutes of Physics where they had been, I was on their task force. It was a great opportunity to look in a discipline, not across all of STEM. And that's, I have actually been studying physics students for quite some time. So I've been sort of in a deeper relationship with them. And this project, they have had they're one of the few STEM fields that have had a drop in Black student success. So they were trying to understand what was going on. So we just wrapped up that project. And it, for me, and they're now trying to take these themes, which center around a sense of belonging in the field, faculty interactions, financial constraints, things of that nature. So I'll probably continue to do a little bit with that, but where I'm also moving to is a lot of this work on climate, not just from what students have shared, but race, equity, diversity is a whole other lens of my life where I've been out in the field doing work. So we just did the Missouri case study.
Okay. And can you say a little bit more about that? And like define campus climate for
So one part of how we've studied students is to say, what is the climate on the campus? Meaning the sense of their sense of belonging, the racial climate, the, it could be sexism, it could be all kinds of factors affect people. If it's a homophobic campus, our LGBT community students may feel. So climate can be lots of factors, right? A lot of things can impact it. But for the most part, in my work, it's been around racial climate for high-achieving Black students. But not all. It's been other factors. So broadly speaking, there's a whole body of scholarship around campus climate and racial issues, sexuality, all kinds of topics. I've actually, a colleague of mine at University of Southern Cal, we did some work with the American Council on Education and the University of Missouri to basically look at the post 2015 campus racial unrest.
Okay.
And we did one report. One of our first monographs came out in 2018. We just finished. It's in press right now. And what we were trying to bring to the field are lessons learned from Missouri.
Okay.
Like, and our whole our primary argument is that campus racial, the climate in the country racially has intensified.
Okay.
And and higher ed and society are connected.
So some
of those things that made them way, and we can continue to expect them to make their way to our campuses. So part of our work has been about how do leaders prepare for racial crises?
Okay, interesting.
So that work is also actually Change Magazine this semester, actually probably within the next month, is publishing a issue of the Change Magazine dedicated to this.
Okay.
So we did a piece in that along with scholars. You'll recognize some of the names who are doing all pieces. So that body of work is something, I don't know that I'll continue researching it per se. I've been doing on the ground work with colleges and universities sort of tangentially in my career. So for 39 years, I've consulted around this topic.
Wow.
And that's actually even more than, I mean, I love my STEM work, but my administrative life was around that. So I work with a lot of organizations, colleges and universities. So I'm doing that.
Okay.
But I'm also, last thing I'll say is that I'll stay with the STEM stuff and writing about Black students. We have a transfer NSF grant going on right now on Black transfers in engineering. So I'm working with a colleague in engineering. So that will, we're producing scholarship off of that, work off of that. But the last thing is a colleague of mine and I wrote an article, I think in 2005, on how we retained each other in higher education as two African-American women who are in a system in which we tend to be outsiders. Large research universities are hard to get an academic career up and going and then become tenured throughout the rank. So that work has been cited and used by a lot of people about as a model. Okay. We were just recently, last year, this past year, 2019, they did a whole symposium at our national conference around that. So we're doing, we've launched a book project, mm-hmm. and we've launched a project. I'm going back to that work.
Okay.
To actually reach out to have other people tell their stories, mm-hmm. how they've used the retaining each other mm-hmm. Concepts that we talk about in there.
That makes me think about, what was that? What was that book called? It's the three African American men who are in medicine. The Pact.
The Pact. That's true. I just got to chill. You're right. Mm-hmm. Because basically, we made a pact with each other that we would retain each other, mm-hmm. and we would. You're right. Mm-hmm. And that is a book that came out like in the 2000s mm-hmm. somewhere.
Right.
So, unbeknownst to us, because I didn't expect it to have. We were trying to. You know, we wrote. It was a therapeutic piece for me. Mm. I had just gotten tenured when we wrote this piece. And part of it is what we realized is that we needed each other. I was
right.
to go. So we tell that story. Mm-hmm. But unbeknownst to us, other people read that and saw that our transparency and vulnerability apparently allowed them mm-hmm. to find each other in spaces. So we've now learned, it's been very moving of uh-huh. how much it helped people. So that's why we're returning to that work.
Okay.
So we're currently under a really serious review with a publisher right now
Great.
For a book on this.
Okay.
So, yeah. So those are the kind of things. So some exciting stuff.
Yeah.
Some other things in there.
Yeah. I hope this is an opportunity to talk more about that.
Yeah,
because I would really like to see that research come out and for others to be able to benefit from that.
Absolutely. That's such a different turn. And we would love to share that with you. And when we get, because we're hoping to get a lot of chapter authors for that. So I'll definitely keep you in the loop on where that goes.
All right. Thank you. All right. So, lastly then, so what would you consider to be the frontier of research in the areas of, so we've talked, I know you have a broad range and I had asked you this question before we started recording.
Right.
And realized when I asked it that we could be talking about the universe, but for the sake of authors, let me paint this picture. So consider the possibility that somebody that's hearing this is interested in getting into research in the same way that you did. You said you started as an administrator, but because of what you had experienced as an administrator, you decided to go into studying high achievement among African American students.
Right.
So if we focus on that specific area and not necessarily campus climate, even though it's just as important, but focus on high achievement, where would you say the frontier is? Let me say one more thing. We were talking earlier about how other scholars in the field had talked about how little there was to build on at the time that they were writing.
Right.
Now that's been probably 20 years now. So
it's a lot more now.
Yeah, so there's a lot more.
Right.
But we were also talking about how there's still gaps, or there's mm-hmm. still places where perhaps mm-hmm. more work could be done.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can encourage other scholars who want to follow in your from your lead, where would you have them go? Where would you have them study?
That's a great question. My brain went first to a conversation that our research team had this past year, and one of my doc students is going to study this in her dissertation. And what we realized is we've been talking a lot and trying to understand the ways in which Black students are navigating these spaces, but we have not interviewed the faculty that they have had to navigate with. We have their perspectives
mm-hmm.
on it. So I think some frontier work has to be done in collaboration mm-hmm. with students and faculty
mm-hmm.
And classroom, mm-hmm. getting out in classrooms mm-hmm. and watching and engaging. But mm-hmm. also, this student did a pilot study talking to several faculty about, and she's developed a survey, but also some questions, to really get perceptions of how do faculty see these students in the classroom. And mm-hmm. you have to get at that in a certain kind of way. So I do think that we need to know more about what's on faculty members' mind. Also, because we've learned a lot from students about what they're interested in researching as mm-hmm. scientists, mm-hmm. which is actually not traditional canons of research.
Okay.
They want to study different kinds of topics that are, they want to kind of give back. They want to do topics that are more related to the communities they come from.
Okay.
So also understanding how scientists who are practicing scientists mm-hmm. are open to or not open to that. So we need more of a well-rounded picture.
Mm.
I also think some of the work we did off of I didn't do this part as much, but the AIP project and opening up, we need to understand more departmental culture.
Okay.
And so from the student experience, we've learned different things, but we only have that. My work has been intensely focused on understanding their lived experience.
Right.
But there's so many things they talk about that have to be studied that right. hasn't been studied as it connects to them.
Mm-hmm.
So doing more case studies of departments, there are some out there,
okay.
But doing more comprehensive case studies of what does it mean to do research in this particular
right.
department or in this field. So there's still, and I would still argue there, we can still do deep dives on Black students' experiences because I've been talking about it as it relates to most of the students have been STEM majors, but what about in other majors? What about, you know, how do people navigate all the way to like
philosophy,
example. Right.
You know.
So, and in fact, I'll close on this.
Mm-hmm.
I had a unique experience last year, 2019, where I got contacted by this African-American male who's on Wall Street.
Okay.
And he's doing a project to talk about academics, to talk about financial stuff, success. But he got drawn to my work because of the high achievement piece and basically wondering why we aren't helping Black students understand how to be, you know, these stereotypes of wanting to make money, being a ball player.
Right.
But what about being successful in business or another field? Because we've privileged STEM because of all the financial, the funding. But what about philosophy, all these other fields? There are people been saying, so we still have all of that work to do as well. So not just narrowly in one. I just ended up in STEM, as it turns out, because I was into the Meyerhofs. I was looking for the avenue of who's defining success. But guess what?
And you were connecting other things to
connecting
what you had
other things,
what
right,
you had built.
Right. But I wasn't, STEM has become, I think for a lot of people, the go-to because of the funding.
Okay, I got you.
No, I'm serious.
Yes,
I've said that to people. I didn't even apply for grants for a long time. I was doing it out of my own pocket.
The research funding.
Yeah, research funding. I was interested in getting to the voices of the students. I wanted to know the stories of students. So I kept my head and the focus on, I want to interview and talk to as many Black students in STEM who happen to be in these non-traditional fields where you don't see as many of us who are high achiever, you know, staying with those definite, who are capable. They didn't get in these programs because somebody gave them a a pass.
Right.
They're very capable students, but what's happening with them while they're in these programs?
Well, thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Well, thank
I really appreciate
you.
The time.
Thank you for even staying up with it. I appreciate that sincerely. Thank you.
All right.
So there you have it. I really enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Freese Britt. She raised so many interesting points. The idea of early exposure to educational events, making a difference. The idea that we have to help our children to learn how to navigate the systems that make up the schools that they attend. And that the quality of our conversation, not just the quantity of our conversations, can make a difference. It reminded me as well of the conversations that my wife and I used to have with other parents at Sidwell Friends School, where both of our children attended. We would share books with each other, or tactics, or other kinds of home-based strategies. And in doing so, I always felt like we were mutually invested in each other's success. It was a great feeling. So hopefully, by posting this interview, you will feel invited into a broader conversation about these kinds of topics. Now, if you have something to share, just go back to the Achievement Factors website and leave a comment. But otherwise, thanks for listening and stay safe.